Yeah.
When those of us who are committed to the creation of oral sculpture can no longer sit and tolerate the prostitution of sound that is proliferating around us, it is time to speak out.
You're listening to CITR FM 101.9, radio that comes to you from the University of British Columbia. The name of the program is Randophonic, and tonight things are going to be rather different. Tonight it's all one way, a world premiere of what we're calling a sonic fiction. All three episodes of Superlative Noise, which is Philip Random's story, in his own words, as extracted by us from the various files and notes he left behind when he disappeared rather suddenly over 12 years ago now. We use them as the basis for the All Vinyl Countdown and Apocalypse, which ran for about a year and a half on Randophonic, November 2011 until this June. And now let's just say, things are going to get a bit more specific. The whole thing's going to run almost 3 hours, with the podcast likely posted sometime tomorrow. Watch out for a fresh installment of The Absolute Value of Insomnia at 2 a.m. this evening. 4 solid hours of generative music. Care of The Absolute Value of Noise. And now, by way of proper introduction for Mr. Random, I'm going to quote myself from the website randophonic.blogspot.com or .ca. They'll both get you there. First up, he's not who he appears to be, being neither Philip nor Random on his birth certificate. All power to the early days of punk, when reinvention of self, relabeling anyway, was all the rage. I met him in early 1981 when we were both young guys driving cab on Vancouver's North Shore. But then the economy crashed, I went back to school, he just kept on driving one way or another. Story of both our lives, I guess. Crashing economies and relevant detours. Welcome to the apocalypse and all that. As for Philip's disappearance, it goes like this. September 11, 2001. Big deal terror attack, way out east gets everyone looking in exactly the same direction. And by the time we got our focus back, certain things were out of place, locally. Including Philip, who hasn't been seen since. Was he in Manhattan that day? Possibly at Ground Zero? Probably not. Didn't much go in for big crowds, and anyway, we're pretty sure he's alive somewhere up the coast. Based on various rumors and at least one outstanding arrest warrant, agriculture-related. Which gets us to the notes, etc. It was his daughter, Chloe, that found them, digging through all the stuff he left at his cabin, literally tons of it. And now here is the rest of the story. Superlative Noise. And yes, that will be me doing the reading, Bill Mullen, host of Randophonic, among other mediated endeavors.
And it's a hard rain's gonna fall.
If there was a perfect radio station, there would be no requirement for the music industry.
Suicide James said that. Would have been the very end of 1979, because I remember it being between Christmas and New Year's. And I didn't even know the guy the previous year. And he'd be dead by the next one. The suicide that earned him his nickname. Sorry, James, if that comes off as a bit callous. If you're out there somewhere, somehow paying attention. But you're the one that bailed. Not me. And it was a hell of an idea. It still is. And here I'm going to extrapolate some. That notion of a perfect radio station that serves no commercial, political, religious, or other agenda. Just non-stop fresh and superlative noise. No advertising. No bullshit. Which gets us to the snare shot. The one that kicks off Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. This is not my idea, by the way, nor is it my good friend Motron's, though he's the one I heard it from a few years back. He gave the credit to Lester Bangs, but I have my doubts. Motron's notorious for confusing his sources. Still, I applaud the basic notion that a sort of secret history of the past more than 3.5 decades, summer 1965 through to the end of the millennium, needs to be shared. And though it's not my story per se, I was there for all of it. And it all started with that snare shot. Not that I was paying attention at the time. Summer 1965, I was barely 6 years old. Yet the universe did shift. Like a rolling stone hit the now, and nothing would ever be the same. Though to be clear, it's not the song, powerful as it is, that started things. It's the snare shot. Which admittedly doesn't really sound that powerful on its own. Best thought of as a final straw that breaks a certain camel's back, I guess. Or a door that got kicked open. Or perhaps a child's thumb, removed from a hole in a certain dike. And young Bob Dylan and various friends charged on through, armed and dangerous and spitting out an avalanche of crazy truth. Which was basically fuck you to stable, predictable, white bread everything. Jack and Jill, the Bobbsey twins, I Love Lucy, Mel Torme singing Silky Soft over your fourth martini. Reality is not stable. Reality contains atoms. And when atoms get split, all bets are off. Which takes us back another 2 decades to July 16, 1945. The New Mexico desert. 5:29 a.m. Mountain Time, give or take a few seconds. The moment of the Trinity test, the first atomic explosion. Indeed, there were some present who genuinely feared it might set in motion an atmospheric chain reaction that would engulf the entire planet. Who says they were wrong? By which I mean, yeah, the bomb did put a quick end to World War II, but what did it set in motion? How did we get from victory parties and ticker tape to the Cold War, McCarthyism, duck and cover, bebop, Jackson Pollock, the birth of rock and roll, James Dean, Elvis, rockets in space, a guy named Kennedy in the White House, Beatlemania, a guy named Kennedy murdered in Dallas, a pointless war in Vietnam, a young man named Dylan compelled to go electric? The easy answer is I don't know. And in the context of all this, I don't really care. That's somebody else's story. This one just takes all that as given and starts with the snare shot. An eruption of strange and rude and paradoxical hope. A future where, for the first time in human history, the worst doesn't happen. Because it can't. Because this particular worst would truly be the end of us all. Call it evolutionary. We finally work all our shit out without resorting to maximum available weaponry. Or we're all doomed. Which gets us to springtime, 1994. A certain cocktail party at a guy named Steven's place. Low rent, less than a block from the commercial SkyTrain. Various music and artist types hanging out. Kurt Cobain has recently killed himself, but we're all tired of talking about it. The conclusion seeming to be that profound sincerity was to blame. And heroin. So we're moving on, throwing in with the next big thing, which seems to be everything that Mr. Cobain and so-called grunge was not. Having insincere, unprofound, blissfully ironic fun. Which means we're drinking, of course. Some guy named Evil Bob mixing things he calls London tonics. Anyway, the music is the thing. People picking through Steven's piles of vinyl, most of it bought dead cheap at various flea markets, yard sales. Nothing remotely organized. At some point, someone puts on Indian Reservation by the Raiders. The one about the Cherokee people. It gets a laugh and a few ironic fist pumps, but it's one of the other songs from the album that strikes me. The sort of vaguish schmaltz take on Barry Maguire's 1965 fire and brimstone mega hit, Eve of Destruction.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring and bullets loading, you're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, so what's that gun you're toting? Even the Jordan River has bodies floating, and you tell me.
It's the accuracy of it, the shit state of the world circa 1965, being no different really than now, except maybe now it's the Euphrates River where all the bodies are floating, not the Jordan. The now of then, 1994, the cocktail party, and the now of now, late 2000, as I jot this down, still bodies floating.
Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy.
Plus at least one other now, which would be summer 1972, which is when I first heard the Raiders version. My cousin Donald's record, he being a year older than me and always at least 2 years cooler. Not that there was anything remotely cool about the Raiders in 1972, which I'm sure is why he gave the album to me for my birthday. 1972 being a key year in all of this. 7 years since the snare shot, 13 since my birth. So there was all manner of stuff, biological, cultural, existential, coalescing, surging, exploding on through. You'll notice a lot of explosions in this. Suburbia, summer 1967. Don Mills, Ontario, to be specific. Though all suburbs are pretty much the same when you're just turned 8 years old. The Dylan snare shot sounded 2 years ago, but I still won't actually hear it, except in vague reverberation, for at least another 4 or 5 years. Nah, I'm still very much a resident of my parents' world, and the craziest music they've got is a Herb Albert album, which isn't crazy at all. Just fun. But what do I want with crazy? I'm a good, normal boy whose ambition is to grow up to be a good, normal man, just like my dad. Always keep my hair short, never miss church, even if it's boring, work in an office, wear a suit and tie, meet a nice, normal girl, buy a nice, normal house, have nice, normal kids, and make them go to church too, even if it's boring. Except something was happening. I believe it started in the ravine, the one that ran behind the houses on the back side of my block. There was an abandoned sewage plant down there, across the railway tracks, all fenced and barbed wired off. But we knew where the holes were, me and my best friend Patrick Gallagher, who was a year older than me, lived across the street, but he was a small kid, so we were a good fit. We'd sneak into the sewage plant, play secret agent or whatever, spy on the teenagers who hung out down there, maybe catch them necking or smoking, or getting crazy out of their mind on drugs. Because it was 1967, the summer of love. True, San Francisco may have been 2,000 light years away, but such was the noise of it, rumors had reached even little kids in suburban Toronto. Crazy hippie teenagers and college kids getting high on LSD, jumping off bridges and buildings, thinking they could fly. I'm pretty sure that's the first time I ever heard those three letters. LSD. Patrick's dad driving us down to an Argos game or whatever, pointing out the bridge that a college kid had recently jumped from, to his death. And then maybe that same trip downtown, Patrick made sure his dad drove by Yorkville so he could see all the hippies. This detour quickly became a necessary part of every trip downtown, because the Yorkville hippies were just so alien, so strange, like some savage tribe from the past, or maybe the future. Special thanks here to Patrick's parents, who were far hipper than mine. Every Christmas he'd get a new Beatles album, so in 1968 it was the White Album. Two records, four sides, most of it miles over our heads. But we sure liked the Monkey song. Who wouldn't want their own monkey? Later on, I discovered it had nothing at all to do with having a pet monkey, but was John Lennon's cynical dig at the great Maharishi's efforts to get into Mia Farrow's pants. Now this didn't seem to fit with the great man's higher wisdom and philosophies. But for 9-year-old me, it was just this crazy rock song ricocheting around my tiny mind while I bombed around the block on my souped-up two-gear banana seat bike, Or maybe I was watching TV, all three channels, Vietnam War, Don Messer's Jubilee, maybe some Hollywood B-movie, the one about American cowboys in the Congo killing natives for some reason or other, which was pretty standard in those days. White men killing non-white men, served up as fun. I remember hearing that the Beatles had broken up on the radio station that my parents listened to. It actually made the news, in amongst all the muzak. I remember Michael something, a genuine hippie moving into the O'Kelly's old place behind us. He had long hair and a deep voice, had to be at least 15. Most important, he had his own rock band. And he was nice, didn't mind if we younger kids hung out when the band was practicing in the garage. Which is where I first heard the truth about why the Beatles had broken up. Because Paul was dead, killed by a walrus while he was crazy high on LSD. This according to Patrick. And then Patrick moved with his family to a place called Lethbridge in Alberta. And then maybe 2 months later we moved too, to Vancouver. Different city, same basic suburb. I remember grade 6, October 4th, 1970. Miss Cable's class, the day Janis Joplin died. It was the first time I'd ever even heard her name. But if kids were talking about it, she had to have been very cool indeed. A few weeks earlier, it had been Jimi Hendrix. But I already knew about him, how he played to a million people at a place called Woodstock, set fire to his guitar. And then a few months later, it was Jim Morrison of the Doors. Patrick's older brother used to have their poster on his bedroom door. The Doors on the door.
I like the way you smile at me. I felt the heat that enveloped me. And what I saw, I like to see. I never knew where evil grew.
I remember the Poppy Family's Where Evil Grows, a big hit locally, Vancouver being their hometown. Joseph Erickson was my new best friend in Vancouver, and it was his favorite song. He said it was about vampires and what happened when they bit you. Evil grew, became part of you.
I never knew where evil grew.
And then we go back to playing Clockwork Orange, dress up in long underwear and other weird stuff, creatively pulverize each other and his two little brothers. Not that we'd seen the movie, but we'd caught the trailer for it at the Twin Cinemas down at the mall. That was a definite plus to this new suburb. The mall was close enough to walk to, just wander over after school. Kelly's Stereo Mart quickly became a cool place to hang out and watch all the hippie teenagers, like having our own little Yorkville. I remember seeing the cover of Adam Hart Mother there, which I didn't get at all. Just a cow in a field. It didn't even say a band's name. Later, Joseph told me it was Pink Floyd. This being still a good 3 years before Dark Side of the Moon would become as common as allergies in springtime. They're acid rock, said Joseph, with an extreme emphasis on the acid. Because acid could eat metal, right? Like the stuff in batteries in the middle of golf balls. Spill some on your hand and it would burn right through you. Burn right through the floor into the ground, all the way to the center of the earth. Actually, I don't think I believe this anymore by the time I was 11 or 12. I didn't even believe in God anymore. Not really. He'd sort of died with Santa Claus.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at all the life.
Which gets us back to 1972, my 13th year. My childhood has thus far been a straight, predictable affair, well within all statistical norms. I'm a mostly good boy who has mostly good friends, gets mostly good grades, gets mostly what he wants for Christmas, mostly doesn't get picked last for road hockey. But everything is about to change. Early July, I'm almost 13, just finished grade 7. I've got nothing ahead of me but eternal summer, pure fun and freedom. Puberty's not even an issue yet. Not really.
Thank you. I'm lying in bed one night and it occurs to me, I have absolutely nothing to worry about. Except you're going to die, whispers a voice from inside me. Maybe tonight in your sleep. Maybe in 100 years. But you will die, and what then? What if it's just nothing? No heaven, no hell, no anything. A switch gets flicked. Nothing. I couldn't sleep. I remember crawling out of bed, going down to the TV room. We had cable by now, 13 channels, and counting. I remember tuning in some cheesy old monster movie. Normally I would have giggled at it, but tonight it scared the hell out of me. I changed the channel, found an old John Wayne Western, cowboys killing Indians. It scared the hell out of me. Eventually I crawled back into bed, too exhausted for TV anymore, still too scared to sleep. I finally just turned on the radio, something I didn't do much in my room, because all I had was a little transistor thing, not much bigger than a deck of cards. Fidelity may be on par with a telephone, but something cut through regardless, as it would for many nights to come. That little radio quickly became a lifeline, even if it was AM Top 40 only. And anyway, AM Top 40 wasn't all that bad in 1972. Yeah, every generation has its pluses and minuses. Born in 1959 means you pretty much missed the 1960s entirely. Always outside looking in, never allowed into the cool part of the party. But turn 13 and holy shit, you had the likes of Led Zeppelin, Jethro Tull, Neil Young riding high in the charts, going head to head with all the bubblegum. Not to mention David Bowie raising his weird, alien, homosexual head. Or Alice Cooper, who was pure evil, murdered babies on stage and tore the heads off chickens. When we got no choice, all the girls and boys, making all that noise. Vancouver had two AM Top 40 radio stations in those days, CKLG and CFUN. So if one was failing, playing Donny Osmond or Tony Orlando or whatever, there was always the other. But Sunday afternoons was all CKLG, because those were solid gold Sundays, when they played all the classics. Which in those days only seemed to go back to 1965. Stuff like the Byrds and Motown, and the Beatles, the Stones, Donovan, Jimi Hendrix, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone. That's when I finally heard it. And the righteous flood that followed.
Fine, do the bump of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you.
I had heard of Bob Dylan already. I knew he was a big deal from various friends, big brothers and sisters. Hell, we sang Blowing in the Wind in grade 4 back in Don Mills, Mrs. Perry being a particularly cool teacher. I also remember hearing his version and not liking it. Voice just so raw, like he wasn't even trying. But that was then. This was 1972. The reverb on that snare shot finally reconciling itself in my bedroom, 7 years after the fact. It helped that there was a band behind him, rocking. Then there were the words, not that I could make sense of them, but they obviously meant something, or else why was he singing them so hard? Here was something that didn't so much make the void go away as be about the void. How there might be something cool about a massive, mysterious universe of crazy confusion. So of course it didn't make sense, it couldn't make sense. And Dylan wasn't the only one singing about this confusion, not making sense. Like Jethro Tull. What the hell was Thick as a Brick about? A song so long it filled an entire album, both sides.
The poet and the painter, casting shadows on the water, as the sun plays on the infantry, returning from the sea. The doer and the thinker, no allowance for the other.
As the and Stairway to Heaven. How was she buying it? The lady who knew.
Oh, it makes me wonder.
And Cat Stevens, Catch Bullet 4, the whole album. Pivotal because it was one of the first two new albums I ever owned, Presents from Santa, Christmas, 1972. Looking back, I'm thinking my dad walked into the Stereo Mart and asked the cool long-haired guy behind the counter what would be appropriate for a 13-year-old boy. and the guy just sold him his two favorite albums of the moment. The other was Van Morrison's St. Dominic's Preview, which I didn't get at all, though it would find me eventually. Cat Stevens found me immediately. Side one, track one, was a song called Sitting, which laid it all out, the nebulous and paradoxical truth about everything.
Oh, life is like a maze of doors, and they all open from the side you're on. Just keep on pushing hard, boy. Try as you may, you're gonna wind up where you started from. You're gonna wind up where you started from. Have a friend on whom you think you can rely, you are a lucky man. If you found the reason to live on and not to die, you are a lucky man. Preachers and poets and scholars don't know it. Temples and statues and steeples won't show it.
It's 1974 now. I'm 14, cruising in on 15, having made a conscious decision to live. Not just survive, fucking live. And taking my cue not from any priest or parent or teacher or hockey coach, but the music, the songs, the promises and mysteries therein, the culture thus inspired. So maybe a few books and movies too. One movie in particular being O Lucky Man, that we snuck into one night down at the Twin Cinemas. Me and my latest best friend, Carl Ferguson, mainly because Carl had heard there was some cool music on the soundtrack. There was. There was also everything else. Every institutionalized absurdity of modern man turned on its head. Be it religion, politics, medical science, big business, the military. Every officially sanctioned illusion as to order, meaning, authority. Exposed, ridiculed, eviscerated, until it just wasn't funny anymore. It was goddamn tragic.
Takers and fakers and talkers won't tell ya. Teachers and preachers will just buy and sell ya. When no one can tempt ya with heaven or hell, you'll be a lucky man.
And yet, like the title song suggested, there's a big if at the heart of it all. And that if is life itself. The very core of the word, when you really think about it. The middle two letters, anyway. Of life. If. Did I mention I was smoking a little dope now? And I was hanging out, getting drunk every now and then, being adolescent, vaguely insane, possibly even cool. And I was horny, for girls, for everything really, running wild and free through fields and meadows, tearing down all walls and fences, dreaming about it anyway. Radio is definitely helping. CKLG FM now, with its longer, heavier, more important sounds. The DJs themselves programming the shows, playing the stuff that mattered to them, guiding a musical journey with their cooler-than-cool voices, which would get you Neil Young, The Rolling Stones, Stevie Wonder, Black Sabbath, Joni Mitchell, King Crimson, Sly and the Family Stone, Led Zeppelin, the Allman Brothers, the Doobie Brothers before they went all lame. A never-expanding universe of significance and cool. But this was about to change, and fast. Do your research and you'll discover that 1974 was pretty much the turning point. The year the consultants took over FM radio and ruined everything forever. I'll even name names, having bothered to do some research a while back. Burkhart and Abrams. Maybe it was inevitable. Maybe if it wasn't those two evil clowns, it would have been someone else. The FM airwaves being suddenly way too lucrative to be trusted to mere lovers of music. But Burkhart and Abrams are the ones who put their names to the crime, killed a beautiful thing, and got filthy rich for their trouble. Suddenly the DJs didn't have a say in what they played. Suddenly the DJs would get fired if they didn't follow the consultant's playlist. Suddenly that cool guy or girl with the alluring voice was the enemy, or working for them anyway. Suddenly so much that was cool and dynamic and worth living for was just gone, or certainly driven well underground.
It's safe in the city.
Which is a big part of what this is all about, I think. My sitting here in deep winter, early 2001, taking note, bearing witness, telling it like it was, to be young and in love, which I was, with the music and the whole crazy cool culture behind it, and to have such easy access to it, just turn that radio on, maybe catch a whole side of Pink Floyd into some old blues, some Tangerine Dream, then the latest David Bowie. The world's best buffet, always serving, and I was always hungry. But then Burkhart and Abrams stole it from me. Stole it from us all. Fuck those guys. At least I had found Carl, or more to the point, he'd found me. Back of the class, grade 9 history. I'm bored, doodling cosmically away in my notebook. He peeks in over my shoulder and asks if I've seen the cover of Brain Salad Surgery, the latest Emerson, Lake & Palmer album. We did already know each other, sort of, having played on the same hockey team back in Pee Wee. But then he suddenly turned cool, grew his hair long, and got into music, it turns out, learning guitar and piano, getting sucked into his older brother Don's world. Don being 5 years older and actually in a band, playing bass for a local hard rock outfit called Fragile. And Carl had a similar plan. Carl was formulating a band to be called the Gemini Rangers. Because I clearly had good taste in art, he wanted me to be part of it, even if I didn't play anything. I could do the album covers, help with the light show, maybe write some lyrics, because I seemed to get good marks in English. Friday night quickly became Gemini Rangers night. We'd hang out in Carl's basement, get high, dig through Brother Don's records, plot our future world domination. And we were going to actual shows now, tagging along with Don, who was definitely cool as Big Brothers go. April Wine was my first proper rock concert, then the Doobie Brothers, Nazareth. And then, inevitably, yes. It's 1975 by now, summer. I'm almost 16. Yes are a band I've heard, but I don't really have a solid opinion on them yet. Their stuff is just so strange, hard to get a handle on. 10-20 minute songs, and the singer has an awfully high voice for a guy. The show opens with a crescendo of recorded classical music. Curtains rise, the stage shimmering like something out of Middle Earth, a great elven hall. And then, holy shit. That concert an intervention, the gods themselves imposing on my affairs, ecstatically so, particularly the last song of the main set, when the glowing crab-like thing rose from the smoke and strobe lights behind the monster drum kit, like the apocalypse itself happening right before my gobsmacked eyes. But don't be fooled, the lights and such were just tricks to keep my attention, the sound was the thing. like these musicians, these sorcerers, weren't exactly playing this music. They were conjuring it, concocting weird potions, shaping and turning this mad and superlative noise that just kept bubbling over, ricocheting all around. Twelve or 13 years later, I'd get the same feeling watching Sonic Youth Live, that the music which matters most isn't made, it's set free. And so those responsible are not so much makers as channelers, like little kids playing in a sandbox, barely able to contain all the crazy stuff erupting from their imaginations. The climax from that Yes concert turned out to be a song called Ritual, from the album Tales from Topographic Oceans. A two-record set, four sides, each a 20-minute epic, detailing an essential theme of human reality, like the four seasons, the four points on a map. It seems I'd found my thing. Not just musically speaking, because music wasn't just music anymore. An easy, two-syllable word. It was bigger now, deeper. A more powerful force than I could ever have imagined, and thus exactly the kind of thing a growing boy could fully devote himself to. Call it my new religion. We hadn't even smoked dope at that concert. We being me and Carl, who'd borrowed Brother Don's car to get there. So he had to promise on pain of slow death that he would not get impaired in any way. And anyway, this stuff was beyond drugs. This stuff was beyond comprehension. Just to be experienced over and over, preferably via headphones. And of course now we were smoking dope, diving deeper and deeper into these strange oceans. Yes wasn't the only band immanentizing eschatons through the early and mid-1970s, and Don's record collection had all the evidence we needed, new and old. Just the album titles alone, Passion Play, Solar Fire, Umagumma, Journey to the Center of the Eye, Lark's Tongue and Aspic, In a Glass House, No Madness, Moon Madness, Nursery Crime, Selling England by the Pound. Progressive rock, it was called. Prog rock, for short. Though I didn't know this yet, and wouldn't until some smug punk rock-loving record store guy set me straight toward the end of 1977. To me, it was just this magical stuff, all these mystical regions to explore, concerts to attend. Which was serious business now, going to shows, which were easy to get to now that I was driving, moving further and further out into that bigger, cooler world beyond the suburb. Having bought a piece of shit Chevy Vega for $500 from Amy Mueller across the street when she went off to university. Like in spring 1977, saying, "Hey mom, I'm going to Carl's after school to work on that history presentation. Probably just stay the night there." Meanwhile, we're on our way to Seattle to see Jethro Tull, the Songs from the Wood tour. ...1977 was a glory year for my kind of shows, starting with Tall in Seattle, then Queen, Supertramp, Genesis, everything coinciding perfectly with high school grad. And then Yes again, touring on their first new album in 3 years, a sold-out Pacific Coliseum. Except they were kind of a letdown, just not that fuse-blowing, revelatory as before. Not that I admitted as much to anyone. Hell no, I was right there, epicenter, true believer, howling loudest of all to perhaps silence those whispers of doubt. In retrospect, the explanation is easy. Prog rock was already done by 1977. In fact, it's pretty safe to say Prague peaked on record in 1974, and then on the concert trails in 1975, the year I first saw Yes, Got Converted. By which I mean that's the furthest it took the monster wave that started with that Dylan snare shot, by way of the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's, Jimi Hendrix, The Cream, The Who, the early Pink Floyd, all that psychedelic yearning loaded into the same cosmic rocket, going, 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 aiming for who knows where, just somewhere, anywhere, far from Earth and its mundane suburbias. Suicide James put it in 1979. It was all there in three albums released in 1974. Yes, Relayer, King Crimson Red, Genesis, Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. The keys to the door of a vast new musical universe that should have been explored if only others had picked up the challenge, continued the progression. But they didn't, it wasn't, it died. But like that proverbial chicken with its head cut off, it didn't know it yet. And neither did I, blind as any zealot. Read the music history books for 1977 and two things instantly leap out. Disco and punk rock, which shouldn't be confused with what was selling, which was Fleetwood Mac, Boston, Boss Gags, ELO, and disco. Fuck, I hated disco. How dare it erupt just as I was graduating high school? How dare it pollute all the available radio stations, and worse, transform all the nightclubs? Now that I finally had good, fake ID. Because disco is the triumph of the shallow. And I'd just endured enough of that in 5 years of high school. I wanted the world now, the whole damn thing in all of its depth and drama and seriousness, with appropriately complex soundtrack. Disco offered none of this, so I hated it. Plus it stole my first proper girlfriend, the still amazing Debbie Keith. But that's another story. Punk rock I heard about before I actually heard it. An article in Time magazine, some muttering at the back of a few cool record stores, the odd side mention in Rolling Stone. It sounded like it was ugly, more noise than music, and thus nothing my progressive palate would be interested in. Then I heard some Sex Pistols, and I didn't even hate them. What was to hate? They were just raw and dirty rock and roll, like Black Sabbath. Except the songs were shorter, ruder, more to the point, and there were no demons or wizards involved. So not bad, just not important. A lesser music. Except something puzzling was going on. People I took seriously were taking it seriously. A few of the local music journalists, some of the older guys who worked at the cool record stores. Quintessence Records in particular, which was the cool record store in town, specializing in imports from Europe and Japan. And the only place I knew of that carried the really deep prog. Stuff that was even more esoterically out there than Yes, Genesis, Tull, Floyd. Except now they were getting behind punk, this lesser music that was just so easy to turn my nose up at. And I was very good at that, 18 by now, which wisdom now tells me is a very stupid age, because you're just schooled enough to think you know a thing or two about how things really are, unlike, say, 12, 13-year-olds who have no such illusions. They just know they're in over their heads. 12, 13-year-old me would have loved punk rock. I remember one night at Carl's, it would have been 1978 by now, because Tornado, the latest Yes magnum opus, was out. Except it was neither magnum nor opus. But I loved it anyway. Just smoking up dope, drinking up beer, crank the stereo loud. I was nothing if not loyal in my stupid true belief. But not Carl, who I hadn't seen that much lately. Me being off at university, working some nebulous pre-law strategy that made my dad happy, I guess. Carl being at college, studying music, where he'd met a guy named Danny Ballard who played bass in a band called Black Ambulance, a so-called new wave band, which was basically just punk with keyboards and slightly poppier songs as far as I could see and hear. A band that Danny had asked Carl to join because the current guitar player was an idiot, getting drunk all the time, skipping practices. "You're not seriously thinking about it," I said. "Sounds kind of fun," said Carl. Then he put on some Devo, their first album. He was right. The fun was all Devo was. Weird costumes and stuff, crazy sort of machine sounds. But they weren't complex or anything. They weren't progressive. Carl could see that, couldn't he? I guess not, because maybe a week later he got a haircut and joined Black Ambulance. And then maybe a month after that he played his first gig with them at a place called The Smiling Buddha. I hung out at the back with my long hair, my brown leather jacket, my slightly flared jeans. Not remotely in sync with the dress code. Not that anybody gave a shit. They were having too much fun, going off, slamming and gobbing and pogoing like the world was ending. Which of course it was. Whatever the hell it was, punk was definitely happening. The gigs, the parties, the overall scene. The cutest, hottest, strangest, most fascinating crowd of people I'd ever come across. Artist types, filmmakers, students like myself, actors, cab drivers, construction workers, nurses, actual homosexuals, out of the closet, horny and unashamed, whoever and whatever. If only the music was better. Or as Suicide James put it the night we met, got to talking, a house party in low rent North Van. Why can't there be progressive punk? Why just this simple hate, spit, puke, destroy? I guess I'd noticed his hair first. Long like mine, but more styled, like a proper rock star. Which was a rather bold statement in that crowd. Then I noticed he was wearing a Genesis button. Which was all I needed. I just met my new best friend, an all-purpose Carl Ferguson replacement. LSD sealed the deal. My first trip. 20 years old and I finally got around to chancing the Beyond Within. Because I really had bought all the scare stories they'd filled me with as a kid. But James insisted. Just the two of us, so there would be no distractions. We had his grandparents' place to ourselves, which he was house-sitting. One of those big, exquisitely run-down old homes, smelling vaguely of ancient crimes and secrets, and strange books written in semen and blood. Was one of James' song titles from the mega concept he was working on called the Shattered Castles Project, which was not to be confused with a mere band, although it did encompass a band. He played me a few things on the old, slightly out of tune grand piano, but he mostly just force-fed me Van de Graaff Generator, because they were the closest thing to the genius stuff he had in mind. Which is something he seemed to have no doubt about, at least while he was tripping. He was a musical and artistic genius, and the world would someday adore him for it. I awoke the next day converted, if a little confused. Maybe not utterly floored by the music itself. It was hard to really grasp his big ideas from the mere sketches I'd heard. But his enthusiasm was thick and nourishing, even with all the ego. Because whatever the hell it was, the Shattered Castles Project was unlike anything happening in the rest of my life at the time. Third year of university by now, supposedly writing the LSAT that spring. Yeah, right. I may have been full of shit about everything else, but I knew myself well enough to know that I was not a lawyer. Or anything else you could put a single word to. What I was a young human being just getting started on an epic journey that would surely take me to the known edges of the universe, and beyond. I wrote as much in the journal I was keeping at the time, the morning after my fifth acid trip. was keeping track for a while, because I was definitely digging this new old drug, the very potion that had made so much of the 1960s happen. Timothy Leary and the Beatles, the Doors, Jimi Hendrix, all those college students throwing themselves off of buildings, thinking they could fly. The truth about the LSD experience is it's far subtler than all that. More about easy vibrations and subtly alluring impressions than hungry soul-eating fractals erupting from the void. That kind of stuff wouldn't happen until my 17th trip. I'd term my early excursions as cinematic, movie-like. Except I wasn't watching this movie, I was in it. And deep and mysterious it was. And important. Because that glow I'd been carrying with me since Yes Live in 1975 just wasn't enough anymore. I didn't just want to be in the audience anymore. I wanted a part in the thing itself. The drama, the comedy, the epic adventure, whatever it was. No, I wasn't an artiste, I couldn't play anything, and I was no singer. But I could sling a few words together, which I was always good at, help James focus things on that level. And I own a van now, so I could haul stuff, organize things, manage. I even got business cards made. Call James and I inseparable for a few months, either side of New Year's 1980, which is when that radio line popped up, the one that ultimately got me started on all this. If there was a perfect radio station, there would be no requirement for the music industry. But more on this later, because at the immediate moment it was just another James line, smug yet emphatic, further evidence of his self-proclaimed genius. February, 1980. I earned my management stripes by securing the Shattered Castles project, its first gig. A warm-up slot for the Toronto-based progressive rock band FM at the Queen Elizabeth Playhouse. Except James wasn't ready. The whole thing was a catastrophe of embarrassment, starting from the moment he stepped on stage and insisted on explaining the overall concept before any music had been played. The first catcall started after maybe half a minute. The project eventually fumbled through two songs, totaling over 20 minutes, before James' keyboard rig melted down and they got booed off stage. The next day, he fired the band, which was confusing because he wasn't paying them anything. And then a week later, I got it too, due to a shift in direction for the Shattered Castles project. We would now be completely concerned with making enough money for James to build his own recording studio, because the only possible road to artistic freedom was total creative control, which made his cousin Greg the new manager, because Greg knew some film biz types who were importing cocaine from California, which was where all the money was going to come from. This all happened right at the beginning of March 1980. Mark it as a pivotal point in the arc of my life, because it also coincided with my quitting school, which I did outright. I didn't fill in any forms, give any reasons, I just stopped going. A snap decision made under the weight of 17 plus years of institutionalized boredom and absurdity. Because even if the Shattered Castle stuff ended up being absurd in its own way, at least it had mattered, gave a genuine sense that my life could be interesting, not just a continuation of school, only worse. James killed himself about 6 months later, September 1980. The suicide that earned him his nickname, assigned in retrospect by a guy named Simon Lamb, who'd been playing bass that night at the Queenie Playhouse. It didn't really hit me that hard on the face of it. I'd barely known the guy a year, and the actual friendship part only really lasted for about half of it, ending with his business commitment to money and cocaine, the stuff that destroyed him. Because it was the perfect drug with no possibility of addiction or overdose. Just a cool, smart, positive buzz. Yeah, it was pricey, but quality's worth paying for. Which is pretty much verbatim what James said to me the last time I really thought of him as a friend. It was at a party he dragged me to way out in Burnaby. We were there for maybe 10 minutes before he ditched me, not to be seen again that evening. I ended up having to hitchhike home, James having driven that evening, his grandfather's old Chevy Nova. The same one he drove head-on into a concrete bridge abutment at over 90 miles an hour. No seatbelt. The note he left laid a pile of blame on his cousin, for introducing him to the film biz types with all the cocaine. We're somehow affiliated with some biker types, who James ended up owing over $10,000. He also blamed his parents for not bailing him out, or just giving him the money he needed in the first place to pursue his artistic ambitions. Likewise, various old friends. I didn't even get a side mention. But I was still there for the aftermath, which is a whole other story that could be told. Grieving young people getting drunk, gobbling magic mushrooms, raging all night in cemeteries to Doors music, as Jim Morrison was going through a sort of resurrection at the time. He's hot, he's sexy, he's dead, said the cover of Rolling Stone. Which is an important point, I guess, in terms of what I'm trying to track here. Because that first Doors album had definitely been part of the initial flood, barely 2 years on from the Dylan snare shot. The big hit, of course, was Light My Fire, but the song that mattered most 13 years later, the autumn months of 1980, with winter looming and a suicide to reconcile, was The End.
There's danger on the edge of town.
Full of shadows and strange angles, hinting at all kinds of twisted possibilities, which is key. It hinted, it didn't force. It left room for you and your movie, your brain and its chemicals.
Weird scenes inside the gold mine. Ride the highway west, baby. Ride the snake.
I was doing more and more LSD as 1980 played out, my overall life settling into a distorted rhythm of sorts. Still living at home in the suburbs with Ma and Pa, little brother and sister, but really just sleeping there, and doing most of that at odd hours, as I was a cab driver now, because I needed income, and it was the easiest, slackest, best-paying job a young man could get at the time. Just get high, bum around, and continue my education informally. The LSD was mostly coming from Simon Lamb, the aforementioned Shattered Castle's bass player, who wasn't a regular dealer at all, just ended up with a 100 lot via some complicated debt payback involving a friend of a friend. He also ended up with a dog out of the deal. Her name was Alice, part lab, with the saddest eyes known to man. She was always with us when we tripped, a necessary part of the ongoing movie, which was at least slightly haunted by James. Because even if he was mostly a stranger again by the time he killed himself, the violence of it remained real. A guy I dreamed with, schemed with, argued with, partied with, laughed with, was gone. A blunt fact I couldn't help tripping over. If anything, the acid was helping me get beyond it, kept pushing me closer and closer to the edge of what was really happening. Both in terms of everyday existence, the fierce urgency of every living, breathing, micro moment, but also in terms of what was going on out in the world, on a macro, socio-political level, where Ronald Reagan had just been elected president. Couldn't people see the horror in that? An actor, not even a very good one, a faker of sincerity, a deliverer of other people's lines, with his finger poised on the doomsday button. And then John Lennon was murdered. December 8th, 1980. Simon and I dropped acid the next night. Listened to a pile of Beatles. That concludes episode 1 of Superlative Noise. Philip Random's story in his own words. Episode 2 will be starting up shortly once we get the jukebox properly tuned here on CITR, FM 101.9, radio that comes to you from the University of British Columbia. Please stand by.